Yes, live mic, just so you know.
I was thinking of that when things came up, because I still work with Brian and Crime, which I know you guys are involved with, you know, signatories, right? It comes from to be behind doing law bills.
Except for that.
I didn't read about that. Oh, you mean, oh, what he's been talking about recently, but it was.
Yeah, they can rule all the time.
I know, sometimes people kind of talk about the law bills and things, which I kind of love. Sometimes I love it, sometimes I hate it. I never know what to wish to on Twitter.
All right, cool.
These two are dying.
Yep.
Good morning. This is a meeting of the Title Setting Board pursuant to Article 40 of Title I CRS. The time is 9:15. The date is Wednesday, March 18th, 2018. We're meeting in the Secretary of State's Aspen Room, 1700 Broadway, Denver, Colorado. The title setting board today consists of myself, Suzanne Steyer, Deputy Secretary of State, on behalf of Wayne Williams, Glenn Roper, Assistant Solicitor General, Designee of Attorney General Cynthia Kaufman, and Jason Gallander, Designee of Office of Legislative Legal Services. There are two titles for each measure. One is a statement and the other is a statement in the form of a question. Changes adopted by the title board of the first title in the staff draft will be considered adopted for the other title. When the board considers a proposed initiative for the first time, the board will follow three steps. First, board members may wish to ask questions of the proponents. This is to ensure that the board understands the proposal. Second, the board will determine if it has jurisdiction to set a title. In particular, the board must determine if the measure complies with the single subject rule prescribed in Article 5, Section 1, 5.5 of the Colorado Constitution and Section 1-40-106.5 Colorado Revised Statutes. This is because the board is prohibited from setting a title for a measure that contains more than one subject. If the measure is a constitutional change, the board will consider CRS 140-106-3.5 as to whether the measure only repeals in whole or in part a provision of the state constitution. Third, if the board determines it has jurisdiction to set a title, the board will use a staff-prepared draft for discussion purposes. A copy of the staff draft is on the table. Generally, we take all testimony first, then the board will discuss and vote after all testimony is completed. A decision is reached by two of the three members of the board. Please take note that we are not concerned with the merits of any proposal here. We are only concerned with the setting of title. Furthermore, we are not concerned with legal or constitutional objections to the measures, except to the extent that such objections relate to the jurisdiction of the board to set titles or to the correctness of the titles and summaries themselves. Anyone who's dissatisfied with the decision of the title board may file a motion for rehearing with the Secretary of State within 7 calendar days. The first item on the agenda today is 2017-2018, number 172, authorizing bonds for transportation projects. Morning.
I'm John Caldera, proponent of this measure.
Mike Krause, proponent of the measure.
All right. Do you want to just start out letting us know what you believe the single subject of your measure is?
The single subject of the measure is fixing our damn roads without raising taxes or fees.
Okay. And have you had an opportunity to review the staff draft? And
I have. And just so you know, a week or two ago, we did, I think it was 169, I'm trying to recall. This
167.
I 167, think. Thank you. This is almost identical, except the funding, the debt is permissive based on revenue. In other words, the legislature doesn't have to issue the bonds if it has cash in hand and wants to build the roads with cash. That's really the only difference.
Okay. Is there anybody here signed up to speak on this issue? All right. Any questions by the board on single subject?
No.
No.
No. You want to make a motion?
Sure. I move that we find that proposed initiative 2017-18 number 172 has a single subject and that the board has jurisdiction to set a title.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right. That takes us to the title. Do you have any comments on the staff draft?
Yes. I'd suggest that the board use the exact same language for 167 as this one. It seems nearly identical, except it's permissive instead of mandatory.
Okay.
If I may ask.
You may not.
Does the permissiveness, I assume that the plan would be to run one of these and not both of them?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Does it matter whether we indicate the permissiveness in the title or not to you?
Not from my point of view, no.
I think maybe in 167 that on line two where it says authorizing, in 167 we had said requiring instead of authorizing.
So we would want to say.
So I do think that's a good change.
Keep in mind, you're looking at one.
Right, but he's saying in the old one we said requiring the issuance of bonds, and you're not requiring them in this one.
That's true.
So authorizing would be a better term.
I agree.
So if we took 167 and just put in the word authorizing, how would you feel about that?
That's fine by me.
Any other discussion? All right, so the way it reads right now, state debt shall be increased by up to $3.5 billion with a maximum repayment of $5.2 billion by a change to the Colorado Revised Statutes authorizing the issuance of transportation revenue anticipation notes with 20-year terms and in connection therewith. No proceeds shall be retained as a voter-approved revenue change and used exclusively to fund specified road and bridge expansion, construction, maintenance, and repair projects throughout the state.
This is different than what you just had up a moment ago on
Yeah, I'm not sure Stephen has copied over 167.
Okay. We'll wait.
So, Stephen, we talked about copying the text from 167 over and just replacing requiring with authorizing.
I'm very disappointed in Stephen, too.
No, we're never disappointed in Stephen.
They look the same to me, but I guess that's why I'm not over there.
All right, so now what we have, state debt shall be increased $3.5 billion with a maximum repayment cost of $5.2 billion without raising taxes or fees by a change to the Colorado Revised Statutes authorizing the issuance of transportation revenue anticipation notes, and in connection therewith, note proceeds shall be retained as a voter-approved revenue change and used exclusively to fund specified road and bridge expansion, construction, maintenance, and repair projects throughout the state. Any discussion?
Just because we're going with authorizing, they might not be issued. Maybe on line four after therewith, I would just say any.
Any note proceeds?
Yes, because they might not be issued.
That's fine.
Ready?
Yep.
With that change, I move that we set the title for proposed initiative 2017-18 number 172 as it now appears on the screen.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All right, that takes us to proposed initiative 2017-2018, number 174, single income tax rate.
John Caldera, I'm the proponent of that measure, and Michael Krause is here as well.
All right. Is there anyone here signed up to speak on, or not signed up, but who wishes to speak on this? Oh.
Just to be annoying, I brought a lawyer.
I'm just going to kick it off.
Oh, you're representing them now. Yeah. Okay. Do you want to start by telling us what you believe the single subject of your measure is?
The single subject of this is pretty simple. It is to protect these flat tax in Colorado, even if there is a tax increase on the that passes this fall.
Any questions on the single subject?
No, I think we're good on
okay.
that.
Want to make a motion?
Sure. I move that we find the proposed initiative 2017-18 number 174 has a single subject and that we have jurisdiction to set a title.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Any comment on the staff draft or the impact?
Yeah, I like to say I don't think the staff draft is right because it says that state taxes shall be increased. If you read the measure, it does not say that taxes shall be increased. It is dependent upon the outcome of a different initiative. Quite simply, it's if a progressive income tax is passed, this then reflattens that tax. So we don't know that it shall increase taxes. In fact, one of the many proposals out there lowers the one of the tax rates, so it could change that as well. So I just don't see that Tabor language applies on this.
What about the impact?
Yes.
Estimate.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, Trey Rutter's representing the proponents. First, I've got electronically and paper copies of proposed revisions to the title. I can hand those up to Stephen. And in addition to Mr. Caldera's arguments, there are two other legal considerations here. Our concerns about the staff draft are, first, as Mr. Caldera has said, it would use the mandatory language of 3C of Tabor unnecessarily. And second, it wholly fails to have it to include a description of the subject of the initiative. Instead, it treats the measure like a tax increase, which it's simply not. Let's start with what 174 would do. There are 19 measures that have been, for which a title has been set or for which a rejection of the title is under review by the Supreme Court, that would repeal the flat tax requirement in Tabor. Now, all of those measures would also create a higher tax rate on income above a certain threshold to fund a negative income tax for low-income earners or, in some cases, non-earners of income. I'm going to call those the triggering measures because the passage of any of them would trigger the effectiveness of 174. So, as Mr. Caldera said, 174 is intended to preserve the flat tax should any of those measures pass. It would do so by applying any new income tax rate applicable in the calendar 19 year to all income, not just to the income above the threshold. It is also another provision of 74 would work to decrease the rate for all taxpayers on all income if any income tax rate for 19 were to fall below the current 4.63% rate. And finally, if we end up with rates both above and below 4.63 for calendar year 19, tax year 19, then all income will be taxed at the lowest of those rates. So to be clear, the single subject of 174 is to preserve the flat tax. It's not intended to raise tax. And in two of the three potential scenarios that could occur, we'd end up with lower income tax rates in Colorado. So for two reasons, the 3C language is not necessary and, in fact, would be misleading to the voters.
Well, let me ask you this. Isn't this just a measure that counters it? I mean, is there really a trigger, or is this a situation where if both pass, whichever has the highest number of votes goes into effect? I mean, isn't this just a conflicting measure?
It's not. They're not inconsistent. At least the rates aren't inconsistent.
Okay.
So there may be a fight over which becomes effective with regard to the repeal of the flat tax. I would tell you that 174 includes language that says this measure takes effect notwithstanding any language to the contrary, and I don't see that in any of the EITC measures. So that would be an argument in our favor. But the rates aren't inconsistent. The rates of any of the EITC measures could take effect as written. 174 would simply adjust the rate on all other income not impacted by 174. So in that regard, they're not inconsistent measures. So first, let me direct you to the Bickle case. That's Bickle v. Boulder, 885 P. Second 215 at 234. In Bickle, Boulder put on the ballot a measure that would grant public service an electric and gas franchise for the city. It also had a contingent sales tax increase that would only kick in if public service was unable or unwilling to pay the franchise fee. That measure did not include the 3C mandatory language. In writing for a unanimous Supreme Court, Justice Malarkey wrote the opinion, and she said, look, this is primarily a franchise measure. It is not a tax increase measure. And so we look at that determine that there is no need for the 3C language. You have exactly the same elements here. The primary purpose, the single subject of 174, is preserving the flat tax, and any tax increase would be contingent. So under Bickle, the 3C language is not required. There's a second very important reason that you should reject the 3C language. There are 19 measures that would repeal the flat tax and that would create a higher marginal rate on income over a certain threshold. There are also two measures, 62 and 83, that would cut the state income tax rate. One would cut that rate to 4.6, the other would cut it to 4%. If all three of these measures passed, after we sort out, you know, which becomes effective, which I would suggest is a task that's beyond the scope of this board, it is entirely likely that we would end up with an income tax rate reduction under 174 to either 4% or 4.6%. So it is not only, as I said, unnecessary to include the 3C language, it is misleading to tell voters that this measure would result in a, you know, $1.8 billion tax increase when in fact it may result in no tax increase or a tax reduction. No contingency is better than any of the others. I would suggest that it's not appropriate for Ledge Council or for this board to look into its crystal ball and to decide that it's more likely that one of the EITC measures would pass than it is that the EITC measure would pass along with 83 or 62. By the way, 83, the petition format has been approved. It's on the streets now collecting signatures. Happy to take any questions.
So are you saying the tax increase happens because of one of the other measures, not because of yours?
Yeah, the tax increase is essentially an effect. There's plenty of case law from the Supreme Court that tells us that the board should not be concerned with how one measure interacts with another measure. You get into effect there, you get into speculation, you get into contingencies that may or may not arise. So that's the reason that we would take out the 3C language, and we would also include a description of what 174 would do, and that's in the red line.
Number 83. The text.
So is this a change to the Constitution in reverse? No.
Oh, in reverse. Well, it's not a change.
The other one passes, and then this takes it back.
Well, so there are two parts of all of the EITC measures.
That's all I needed to see.
The first change would be a repeal of the constitutional flat tax provision.
Right.
Then the second change is statutory, just a creation of a higher marginal rate and on income over a certain threshold. So yes, it would. The effect, if both of the measures passed, would be to move that flat tax out of the Constitution and into statute.
Okay,
thanks. That's all I needed to see. That's what I thought. Mr. Rogers, a concern I have is that you've indicated that, you know, based on what we know is out there in the universe of initiatives, we could have, there's the two that reduce tax rates. But 174 specifically references income tax rates imposed under Section 3922-104, and the tax rate change is not in 3922-104 under either 62 or 83. The challenge with that for me is that I don't see a scenario where this measure passes with anything that doesn't increase taxes. And that's why I think the staff draft has the 3C language, and I think that the fiscal impact statement reflects that issue as well.
The effect of 62 or 83 would be a change in those income tax rates.
So but not under that statute.
It would change those rates. I mean, the rate under 104 would no longer be operative if 62 or 83 passed. So it invalidates sections of 104.
So is it your belief then that if 62 or 83 passed and this passed, that essentially there would be with the credits and things, because I believe 62 and 83 both had very large fiscal impacts, that we'd have a rather dramatic tax reduction by operation of both working together?
I have no idea, Mr. Gellender. If 62 or 83, along with one of the triggering measures, and 174 passed, we would have some very complicated questions of statutory interpretation where there are conflicting measures. Those would have to be resolved. I suggest that would certainly involve a court, maybe the legislature and a court. My point is simply that this board, looking into its crystal ball, considering all of the hypotheticals that involve the passage of one of the triggering measures, 174 and either 62 or 83, you are in a hopeless situation if you are going to try to put a tax rate increase. You're in a hopeless situation if you're going to call this measure a tax increase. That is not clearly the outcome. There are dozens of scenarios that might change that outcome. And so you hear economists talk about a projection is wrong 100% of the time. Your title would be wrong almost certainly in every instance, and it would mislead the voters. The way out of that problem is to take the 3C language out. Bickel allows you to do that, and the fact that we have an uncertain, we have uncertainty about what the outcome would be based on the moving parts that are out there in the title world right now requires that result as well.
Is right. The economist here?
Yes.
Madam Chair, members of the board, for the record, Greg Sobetsky, economist, legislative council staff.
Thank you. So does this measure, is this measure an increase or is it an implementation of a measure that is going to result in an increase?
Madam Chair, the way that the fiscal impact statement processes this measure is that based on the three scenarios that Mr. Rogers described, there are possibilities contemplated in the measure for increasing tax rates to match a higher tax rate that's enacted through one of the so-called triggering measures, reducing tax rates to match a lower tax rate in one of the so-called triggering measures, or in the case that multiple tax rates above and below 4.63% are enacted in the triggering measures, reducing tax rates to match the lowest of those rates. The fiscal impact statement, however, perceives this measure to trigger only in the case of 14 measures that have received titles from this board, all of which authorize higher graduated tax rates in addition to the current law 4.63% rate. And in that case, this measure would result in an increase in taxes on
above and beyond?
Yes, ma'am. Okay.
I guess that's my question. This would result in a tax increase if one of those 18 triggering, is that how many we said?
So the fiscal impact statement perceives there to be 14 that have been titled. We don't, you know, contemplate a situation in which a measure that's been rejected by this board is instead approved for a title by the Supreme Court. Right. In the case of Initiative 62 or Initiative 83, It's not clear to Ledge Council that either of those initiatives would cause this measure to take effect because they don't repeal the language in Article 10, Section 20, Subsection 8, Paragraph A that requires the assessment of a uniform tax rate.
But if one of the other triggering initiatives passes, this would raise taxes above and beyond whatever that other triggering initiative does by this amount.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Okay. Right.
And did you consider what would happen if one of the triggering measures and this measure and either 62 or 83 were to pass?
I guess the fiscal impact statement does not directly contemplate that circumstance. The fiscal impact statement doesn't opine on 62 or 83 whatsoever because the fiscal impact statement doesn't perceive those measures as triggering 174. In addition, the language in 174 is specific, as Mr. Gallander pointed out, to the tax rate that's imposed in 3922-104. That rate is changed in the 14 measures that are contemplated in the fiscal impact statement, and it's not changed in 62 or 83. So in a world where 62 or 83 were to pass, and also one of the EITC measures were to pass, at that point there would be a statutory conflict where two income tax rates would be in statute, and that's a conflict between those two measures before 174 enters the mix.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Make a couple of quick points, Madam Chair.
Sure.
Thanks.
First, we do intend to file for rehearing on the fiscal analysis. Second, you know, while the triggering, the triggers for 174 are the however many EITC measures that would repeal the flat tax are out there, it's not limited. It is not limited to those measures or even to 62 and 83. You know, if the General Assembly were to convene in January and decide to cut a rate on income under a certain threshold, 174 would be operative there. It would result in a lower tax rate. So there's another hypothetical, another condition that you would have to consider in setting this title. And then finally, let me again refer back to 83, I think 62 has the same language. While Mr. Gellender is correct, it creates new sections of tax code. It very clearly would drop the rate, as would 62, and then it includes language that says that the language of 83 shall supersede all conflicting laws, rules, and practices. I mean, I don't think there's any question that. You know, perhaps even the reviser would have to go into 104 and strike out the 4.63% tax rate, or maybe not. But in any event, the tax rates in 104 would simply go away. They would have been superseded by 83 or 62 if one of those passed. Thanks.
Are you saying that if there's one of the triggering measures is enacted and this measure were enacted, and then there were a subsequent change in the law enacted by the General Assembly, say that these provisions would still affect the applicable tax rate? You know,
that's right. And I'm not talking about an inconsistent action by the legislature. Right. I'm not suggesting the legislature would undo 174. But if you look at 503C of 174, it says, if income tax rates that would be imposed on the federal taxable income of any individual estate or trust under 104 for that taxable year include rates that are both above and below 4 63/100%, the lowest such tax rate is imposed on the entire federal taxable income, et cetera.
I think you're answering my question, which is if one of the triggering measures and this measure were enacted, this would not be limited to affecting the rates from the triggering measures. It would then continue to affect future rates.
That's right, and not only in 19, but in all future years.
So I think the issue with this one is sort of how far down the rabbit hole of effects can we go or should we go? So the way I look at it, I mean, first, I think philosophically, our duties to the Constitution, and then to the initiative itself in the statutes. So the first thing we have is, of course, Tabor. And Tabor wants the people to have notice of measures and with very specific language that are going to result in tax increases and has specific requirements for how we give that notice. That said, I think with something like this, it's contingent. We can probably accommodate that Tabor requirement and then qualify it thereafter in a way that reflects what's going on. Secondly, when I look at the measure, and I think we're going down how far the rabbit hole to go. So I think the first rabbit hole is, what does the measure say? And it says it only takes effect if an initiative measure passes in 2018. So the General Assembly can't do anything to stop us. All we have to think about is what a title's been set for so far or could be set for, and we know that entire universe as of now. And the trigger also requires that repeal the constitutional measure. So we're just talking about the 14 measures referenced in the fiscal impact statement, all of which any combination of which or any one of which alone in conjunction with this measure would result in a tax rate increase. So as far as 93, that I agree does not apply. I forget the reason it's actually in the fiscal impact statement, because it doesn't repeal the Article 10, Section 28A. And as for 62 and 83, then the only question I'm left with that is, if one of those passes, is that farther down the rabbit hole than the other 14 or not? And to me, because 174 has that specific reference to 104, and 62 and 83 don't amend the tax rate in 104, at least not directly, and it gets more speculative and, as I would say, farther down the rabbit hole. So my inclination is to say that we should start this with the Tabor 3C language, and then I have some suggestions on language and how to sort of qualify that and limit it after we say it to more accurately reflect what the measure does.
Yeah, as far as the 3C language, I'm really not sure whether we need that or not, just given the contingencies that have been talked about. Although I'm willing to look at your language and see what that might look like.
You do that fast.
Is that up there already, Stephen?
Yeah, that's what okay. We just put up.
So I think my concern about the language there is that the reference to a smaller amount doesn't account for the possibility that it might be by nothing or that it could be a decrease. So the nothing would be if one of the other measures doesn't pass. And then the decrease would be if 62 or 83 passed and were considered to take precedence over the triggering measure.
See, and this is sort of the philosophical, how far down the rabbit hole question is what my position with this language is that 62 and 83 don't interact with this measure per se. This measure will do its thing, and if 62 and or 83 overwrite that thereafter, it's not as a, it's on their own terms, not as a interaction per se with this measure. Well, at least that's my theory on it.
Because of the different statutory sections?
Yes.
So how about the scenario where this measure were to pass and one of the four, and none of the 14 passed, then you would not have any increase.
Right. Well, one of the 14 has to pass, or this one doesn't take effect.
One of the triggers has to pass, or this one doesn't do anything.
Right. And in that scenario, there would be no increased taxes.
But that says it in here. I mean, each of them say contingent upon. Right?
Yes, I believe
I mean, it says it depending on what happens.
Yeah, and maybe I have to tweak that depending a little bit to put it in a more to reflect the contingency a little more clearly, but you know, it's a first draft, as they say.
Can I make a suggestion that if you're going to put in the C3 language that you feel it's necessary, and I don't know, we don't, it's a potentiality. So state taxes shall potentially be increased is more accurate.
Yeah. Well, I think Mr. Bruce, unfortunately, didn't give us that precise option, but your point's well taken. I think we can find a way to work it in a little bit after his mandatory
language. We could call him
language.
Up right now and just ask him if it's okay with him.
Let's not.
I'm not sure he has a say anymore once it's in the Constitution.
Well, there's that, too.
I don't know that we need the 3C language. I mean, at the point that everything is contingent upon everything else, I just don't know that it's a... I don't think this is a tax increase initiative. I think it's just an initiative to change back to a single rate. And we don't know that that is really going to have a definite impact one way or the other based on what passes. I'm just not entirely comfortable saying that this is a tax increase question.
Yeah, and I guess that part of the issue is, do we even go the first step down the rabbit hole and look at what other measures are actually on the table and potentially going to be passed? Or do we just look at it more as an abstract measure?
I don't know. The whole measure is all about something else that's going to get passed. I mean, that's kind of the problem.
Right.
It's not a standalone measure. I mean, it would be easier if the measure just said, we're going to have a flat rate, and then they were just competing measures. And, you know, whatever got the highest wins, but that's not how this is played out.
I guess the question I would ask is, would voters be, if we don't have this kind of language in it, are voters likely to be very surprised if this passes and an education, you know, one of the 14 passes and there's a very large tax increase, and say 62 and 83 don't? I mean, and is that a concern that's big enough that we should have some way of telling them? And maybe it doesn't have to be exactly the 3C language if the argument is that this measure in and of itself and by itself doesn't increase taxes. But I mean, I think under the scenarios, if the measure takes effect, from all we know, it's going to increase taxes. And I think we should say, I think the people would like to know that, and I think Tabor requires us to let them know that.
Well, I mean, I think if we decide that Tabor requires us to let them know that, then we have to start right. with the Tabor language.
Yes.
I don't think there's a way to say Tabor requires it, but we're going to put it somewhere else.
Right. And it is this odd situation where it's, does Tabor require it for a measure that requires it only if something else passes, but only takes effect if something else passes?
And I mean, maybe not if something else passes.
Chair, could I jump in with a quick comment?
Sure.
I haven't heard any discussion of Bickle. And again, Bickle is on point. In Bickle, you had an oil and gas franchise initiative that had a contingent tax increase. And the unanimous Supreme Court said, that's a franchise measure. You don't need the 3C language. The fact that there's a contingent tax increase in there does not trigger 3C. Let me just read a little bit from Bickle. The primary purpose and effect of City Question B is to grant a franchise to public service and furnish gas and electricity to the city and its residents. Although the ballot title also seeks authorization for a contingent tax increase of up to $8 million annually, such an increase would only be implicated if a highly unlikely event were to occur. That is, that the city were somehow unable to collect from public service. In our view, City Question B is thus more properly viewed as a ballot issue for the granting of a franchise rather than one for tax or bonded debt increases for the purpose of Subdivision 3C. Therefore, the city was not required to begin the ballot title for that measure with the language, shall city taxes be increased by up to $8 million? I think that answers the question. You don't have to include the 3C language. Tabor is not triggered here. Thanks.
When a contingent tax is highly unlikely, as opposed to this situation where it seems at worst highly likely, and I think if the measure actually takes effect, inevitable.
I think what the court was saying here, they weren't hung up on the contingent nature of the tax increase. They were instead where the court begins is an examination of what the primary purpose and effect of the measure is. And they say the primary purpose and effect is to grant this franchise. The fact that you've got a contingent tax increase doesn't convert this into a 3C Tabor triggering tax increase.
Yeah, I'm kind of inclined to go that way.
To go without 3C language. Okay. Well, we can vote it and see where we are.
Yeah.
You know, because I'm also thinking about, you know, the trans case, the interrogatories on House Bill 1399-1325, where very simplistic analysis, the court kind of said, this thing is big enough that the voters should know about it, essentially, they get to vote on it. They would expect, you know, in their intent in approving Tabor, they would expect that this is the kind of thing, you know, they'd get to vote on. I know they get to vote on it here, but I mean, if we don't, I mean, it's definitely not a super clear area, but if we don't do 3C, I think we need to do something in here that lets people know that the most likely scenario is a fat tax increase if they pass this thing and something else passes.
Yeah, I mean, I'd be fine with describing it later in the measure. I mean, it's really, in some way it's the proponent's dice to roll, if that's the way the board went. It's last day of title setting, and the court strikes it, it's gonna be hard for them to do much with it.
I,
I think I'd be inclined to not include the 3C language at the outset, but to make clear in the measure the potential effect, or I should say the potential increased tax that could come if it were to go into effect.
Okay. Well, if one of you wants to propose some language, carry on.
So I think we would then start with the proponent's language, which is striking the tax language and saying a change to the Colorado Revised Statutes concerning the preservation of. Do you have this, Stephen? I can give it to you. Oh, okay.
Now, I did notice in Jason's language that he changed flat tax to
one rate. That just tracks the Tabor language.
Yeah. And I would be, I don't know if we've used flat tax in a title before, but I'd be concerned about catchphrase there, and I would prefer to track the
one rate
language.
And I do think it's significant to say non-corporate, since the corporate tax is not affected by this measure. Actually, it's kind of a mess right now because these things aren't blending well. What do you have up there now? Is that the staff draft that you're based on? Or you?
What's up there right now is the proponent's proposed draft.
Oh, the proponent's proposed draft, okay.
I think we could take out the proclamation by the governor part.
I think if you go to mine, I think I just had something really simple like 2018 initiated measure and got out rid of general election and all that.
Okay,
too.
Yeah, that'd be good.
So I have an issue with the single subject here in the sense that I think the reference to the constitutional requirement isn't helpful because the General Assembly can change it whenever they want. So there's no constitutional requirement being preserved.
That's fine.
And this would only go into effect if that requirement were taken away.
Exactly.
So get rid of set forth.
Yeah, set forth through Constitution on lines 2 and 3. Stephen.
Yeah. In fact, I think if it only takes effect if that's actually gone, then it's not really preserving anything. It's a, I would say, concerning a requirement that all, that the taxable income of any Colorado individual, estate, or trust be taxed at one rate.
I've been playing with it, Madam Chair. I was heading in the same direction, but maybe in language that tracks the initiative a little more closely. Concerning the requirement for a single income tax rate on individuals, trusts, and estates.
Can I ask a question about that, Mr. Rogers? The question is this. Is that actually what happens, or is it that any one individual's income all has to be taxed at one rate? So for the example I'm thinking of is if different rates are imposed based on an individual, like some sort of means-tested thing, an individual's income, where they said, like, a taxpayer makes $50,000 or less, all income is taxed, you know, at 4%. If they make $50,001, they could all be taxed at 5%. But all of their income is one rate, because that's what I think the measure actually does or could do, depending on sort of how things can be structured in the future. I don't know that it says there's only one rate for all Colorado taxable income of every individual estate or trust. I think it says that any specific individual estate or trust is going to pay the same rate on all of their income.
I'm not sure I get the distinction. I just missed the distinction there.
I think that under the measure, it's conceivably possible that, say, you say there's a lower rate. Let's see. I'm making the lower rate.
I mean, there couldn't be a lower rate.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Say a measure passes that says, I mean, now it's not, but this applies in the future, as we've said. The General Assembly passes something that says, if you make $50,000 or less, your income tax rate is 3%.
Everybody's rate goes to 3% on all income.
No, but then it says, if your income is $50,001 to $100,000, your income tax rate on all of your income, not progressive like we're doing it now, not 3% for the first 50, 5% there, is 5% on everything. It seems to me that could be done. There'd be a single rate for every specific individual, estate, or trust, but not necessarily the same rate for all of them.
Well, I'm not sure I read it the same way. Because that would, in the scenario described, that would put us under C of the measure, right, where you have some above and some below.
Right.
Then it says the lowest such tax rate, meaning the 3%, is imposed on the entire federal taxable income of every individual estate and trust.
Yeah, but I don't, let's see.
I agree with that, Mr. Roper. That's the way I read it as well. I mean, I suppose it would be more technically correct to say a single income tax rate on the income of individuals, trusts, and estates. I mean, it really is the rate applicable to the income, not the individual.
I would just rather say on the income of any individual trust in a state, at least covers the possibility of the ambiguity if I'm in any way right. But I would just say something like, concerning the requirement that that all of the income of an individual trust or estate be taxed at a single rate. actually, I think what I'd say is I'd say any individual trust or estate. And I think I'd say a requirement, just because I think it's technically a new one now. Thanks, Steve.
And I also note that I later we talk about individuals, estates, and trusts. I mean, that probably ought to be consistent instead
yes.
of trust, and trust or estate. So just flipping estate and trust. In the
what does it say in the measure?
I think we had a little subconscious court law school flashback.
That's
there.
That's exactly what happened. Which,
individual estate and trust. So, Mr. Rogers, what's your reaction to that single subject language?
I think that's a vast improvement, Mr. Roper.
Proponents are okay with it. I'm okay with that.
Okay.
So then we get to how do we want to talk about the increase? Or do we?
Okay, well, first thing, let's take out what we sort of can take out. So I think we can take out that providing that only on line 7 and 8, providing that only one income tax rate shall apply at all. Since yeah. we've made it the single subject, basically.
So,
just to trust for now. More might come out, but I've got to think about it.
So what if instead of what we have on 4 and 5... instead of depending on which, if we say if an initiated 2018 statewide ballot measure is approved that repeals
the existing constitutional one rate requirement or something like
yeah.
that. I think you've got it.
Yeah, you got it down there anyway.
That repeals, I like Jason's suggestion there, that it appeals the existing constitutional one, right?
So now I think we're in the situation where it's, I mean, the repeal is the trigger, so it could be that measure or anything else ever in the future. It seems like that imposes a different rate, so we have to reflect that.
Right.
So
do we need a providing in there now?
Not if I can help it.
Okay.
That repeals the existing constitutional review. And oh, maybe we do. I would just say, and if that measure or another, it's not even another measure, another law.
We could do passive voice if a income tax rate higher or lower is imposed.
don't think we can say Laura.
But this is okay. This is all right. If that measures.
And I also think we can say an income tax rate other than, rather than lower or higher than.
So on lines 10 and 11, do we need to account for the non-corporate
aspect? I think so. And now, since we've got the individual estate or trust up there, I mean, I think, my guess is what we could just say, Benny, I think we should probably just say, instead of individual estate or trust, non-corporate taxpayer in the single subject, then we can just say it below and we don't have to keep repeating that phrase. If we do both, I think it gets confusing.
Yeah. That accurate?
I believe so.
Okay. Mr. Rogers, that's accurate. It's every non-corp, I mean.
I'm not comfortable with it because I'm not sure if it's accurate. I mean, okay. I'm not sure that the entire universe is corporate and then individuals, trusts, and estates.
Well, it doesn't have to be legally.
Well,
I mean, it has to advise the voters. It doesn't need to be all that precise, but.
Yeah, I mean, is an LLC a non-corporate taxpayer?
Yeah, that's what I don't know that it needs to be that precise. I guess I'm just.
I think we have used non-corporate in past titles as shorthand for individuals, estates, yeah, and trust.
One other comment, if I could. On line 7, the existing constitutional one-rate tax requirement, single rate may read better, and it would be consistent with the single subject statement up on line 2.
I think one rate is the term in the
Constitution. It is in the Constitution. They ought to be consistent, it seems.
In the right language is one, we think.
I think that is what it says.
It does.
Also gets rid of the article, which is nice.
Article 10, section 28A.
Any income tax law change after July 1, 92 shall also require all taxable net income to be taxed at one rate, is the language. And that gets me down to lines 10 and 11. So now the single subject talks about the income, taxing the income of a taxpayer, and then we've still got the old language on 10 and 11, rate on some taxpayers.
I think we'd say on the income of any non-corporate taxpayer.
Well, since we've got it up there, the income, we can probably just say such income, I think, is. And that's nice because it.
Stephen, will you collapse it so we can read it? I'm not that I'm going to read it right now, but just so we can track it.
So I think what we probably say is something like any such income, and then below we separate it by all such income, right? So it's, no, not up to, so on line 5 before such, I would do any. Then on line 6, I think after income, you get rid of then that and said, or get rid of then. And this may not be my grammar, but requires that tax rate to be imposed on all such income.
Instead of that requires on line six, should we say requiring?
Probably. I'm still.
I got a little lost in the grammar there. Yeah.
On line four, I'm going to try something. Take out the comma after requirement, and then take out the if just shortly after that. A semicolon after income on line six instead of a comma. I'm sorry, after the other income. Sorry, I didn't realize there's two of them.
Go ahead.
Can try one more time on this. The more I look at non-corporate, I'm uncomfortable with it. I mean, we have clear language in the initiative
now.
That's right.
Yeah. So the brevity argument doesn't apply. So.
Okay. We can go back.
I think with adding a few more words, we could make it more precise.
Estate or trust, sorry. You didn't even go to law school. Why are you doing that?
Sometimes I like to pretend.
Your brain's supposed to still work.
Do you want to add something in about the whole raising your taxes?
Well, I'll think about that in a minute. I just want to think about one other thing first. Revenue attributable to the income tax rate improvement. I do have, I think, a question for Mr. Rogers, and also for the board. It says below, any revenue from a higher tax rate is a voter-approved revenue change. I mean, weird that it is. The language of the measure actually just says attributable to the rate, whether it's higher or lower, even though you don't really have to exempt it if it's lower. I wonder if we just say that any resulting revenue is a voter-approved revenue change.
That'd be fine.
So I think right after your semicolon is where is one place we could put in language about the potential increase.
Do you mind, does anyone mind if on line four, instead of saying the existing constitutional one rate tax, which is a weird phrase requirement, we track the Tabor language?
The requirement that all taxable net income be taxed at one rate?
Yes, or something like that. Constitutional, yeah, requirement. After, yeah.
All taxable net income be taxed at one rate?
Yeah.
Although, does that mess up our such income on the next line?
Oh.
Which was intended to refer to the income up on line two.
I mean, I guess we could just repeat individual estate or trust. It's only once. Keep the such or get rid of it. Yeah, down there.
Oh.
You think we should keep it in even with the list or no?
I've just observed that is an accurate statement of what the Constitution says. I mean, the constitutional language is not limited to individuals.
Right.
So I think that's accurate without repeating. I mean, it would be inaccurate to say the Constitution is limited to individuals, estates, and trusts.
Right.
Oh, okay.
No, we're down below a little bit, seeing if the such now, it's confusing what it refers back to. So I think we should probably just say, yeah, I guess we say any individual estate or trust income. So
yeah.
It's unfortunate, but it's what it is. We've certainly set longer ones before.
Sure. Well, and considering how complex this one is, we're doing pretty well.
I think so. So now that we're to here, notwithstanding that I wouldn't have gone in this non-3C direction to begin with, since we don't have to do it, I'm wondering whether the consequences, the likely consequences, do rise to the level of having to be here, or if the Blue Book and proponents and opponents can fight it out through the process and let the people know that way.
I mean, I think the people will guess when they read providing any resulting revenue. I mean, that's sort of triggering you to understand that there may be resulting revenue. I mean, that revenue has to be as a result of this change, right? I don't know.
I was going to suggest that on line seven that we say requiring that tax rate, whether higher or lower, to be imposed on all such income. But that got me worried about whether it's accurate to say if it imposes an income tax rate other than the current rate, Meaning I'm worried that our current language doesn't account for a potential change where you'd have some higher and some lower tax rates, in which case this measure would default to the lower.
Well, we can replace "and" on line 5 with one or more in income tax rates, if that helps.
Say that again.
Instead of "and" on line 5, so imposes one or more income tax rates other than.
So it, just so I understand the way this works, if you had, if there was a law enacted that imposed rates of 5% and 6%, this would choose the 6%.
It would choose the 5%. Well, it would choose 6. Sorry. Yeah. If it were 4 and 6, it would choose 4.
Right.
If it were 5 and 6,
if it were 3 and 4, it would choose 3. If it were 5 and 6, it would choose 6.
That's right.
I'm just sort of hard-pressed to say how we capture that without just creating more confusion than anything else.
I agree. It's...
And given that, we do in the draft for the General Assembly, you know, there's the general, that this, and I think it's even in the statutes, that the singular includes the plural. I mean, I don't know that voters know that, but I mean, I think we have a choice. We get a lot longer and more convoluted and balance that against confusion versus let the blue book, the proponents and the opponents, be the information and just kind of go with the sort of bare bones approach we have here. I don't know that we have a very good middle ground. So it's a question of, you know, whether we want to go longer and potentially both more and or less informative, or stick with what we have.
I don't know, Mr. Rogers, you have a take on that?
It's a conundrum. I think simplicity is probably better here. You would really have to get down in the weeds to cover 3 scenarios.
I mean, I suppose if there's an opponent who wants to come in and make that argument, then we could hear it next time.
Well, I think that'll probably happen.
Certainly on the 3C issue.
So. To hear.
I guess I'm okay with this.
Yeah.
Pending a better suggestion.
Yeah. Okay. We have anything else? I'm just going to read it while we think about it. It's a change to the Colorado Revised Statutes concerning a requirement that all of the income of any individual, estate, or trust be taxed at one rate, and in connection therewith, if an initiated 2018 statewide ballot measure is approved that repeals the existing constitutional requirement that all taxable net income be taxed at one rate, and that measure or another law imposes an income tax rate other than the current 4.63% on any individual estate or trust income, requiring that tax rate to be imposed on all such income, and providing that any resulting revenue is a voter-approved revenue change exempt from any state revenue spending or other limitations in law.
Good?
Yeah.
All right.
I would move that
the board set the title for proposed initiative 2017-18 number 174, has just been read and now appears on the screen.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right, that takes us to proposed initiative 2017-2018 number 169, compliance with federal immigration law. Do you want to just start out by introducing yourselves for the record?
Floyd Trujillo.
I'm Tom Tancredo, one of the providers of the initiative.
And do you want to just begin by telling us what you believe the single subject of your measure is?
It's basically compliance with federal immigration law.
Okay. Is there anybody here who wants to speak on this initiative? No? Okay. So starting with single subject, any questions from the board on the single subject?
No.
No.
All right. Do you want to make a motion?
Yes. I move that we find the proposed initiative 2017-18 number 169 has a single subject and the board has a jurisdiction to set a title.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All right. That takes us to the ballot title. Do you have any comments on the staff draft?
No.
Well, only to the extent.
Oh, to the draft, yes. That's correct. On the title board, was draft number 11, I believe it was. Requiring each jurisdiction. It should read requiring each municipal jurisdiction.
That was changed then in the final, but the question was, what about the draft? And the draft is where that was wrong. But it has been changed as I read the final. I think that has been taken out.
But not in the draft.
So in the draft, it's incorrect?
Correct.
But in that respect.
No, I mean the staff draft.
They may be talking about the draft.
No, I'm talking about this measure. Title.
No.
Oh.
It's okay.
Okay.
I have a quick question for the proponents, just to see if I understand. Under the section that's the meat of it, the 24-33.5-2103, down in subpart 2, finding of sanctuary jurisdiction, does that subsection do something? I didn't see it referenced elsewhere in the measure. Just talks about when a jurisdiction is deemed to have created a sanctuary jurisdiction policy. Mm-hmm. Does that policy play out somewhere else that I'm not seeing?
No.
In the measure? Okay. And that's just so I understand.
There's no penalty.
Correct.
Right.
We anticipate, but there is no penalty specifically identified in the proposal, but we anticipate that if indeed the state of Colorado determines that it is illegal to establish a sanctuary municipality or under the definitions, there may be indeed the possibility for people who have been injured as a result of having a sanctuary city to take some action against that city. But that is not in here. It's just an anticipated outcome.
Thank you.
And indeed, just for clarification, one other thing. This is the language of Senate Bill 220. We simply adopted in case the 220 doesn't pass, which is a distinct possibility, of course.
So I've got Steve prepping sort of an alternative to the staff draft that I've done up myself. I have some concerns about the staff draft. I mean, first, I'm not, I think illegal immigrant sanctuary policy is a pretty loaded term, maybe not necessarily a catchphrase per se. I'm not opining on that right now, but I think there are
less sort of more neutral ways to state that. And I think reading the measure itself, it doesn't seem like it's exactly prohibitions. Really what it's about is having the state and local governments comply with federal immigration law.
Correct.
So I think if that's really what the purpose is, that's what how we should write it. So. Apologies for the delay here.
Oh, no, that's fine.
Just got this to him.
I'm sorry, could you tell me what it is that about that phrase that you think is objectionable?
The sanctuary part, you mean?
Yeah.
For
the illegal immigrant part?
Well, I think sanctuary city on one side or the other. Could be a catchphrase. And so it's more something that would be used, I think, in the advertising than in a ballot question. I mean, I guess you could think it's a good thing or a bad thing, but it's kind of, it's not really a legal term of art. It's more of a catchphrase used to describe something. And so.
Okay.
And as is illegal immigrant, I think the federal statutes say some persons lawfully present, not lawfully mm-hmm. present, mm-hmm. drier things like that.
Right. That is true. And perhaps we could, we are without benefit, unfortunately, of lawyers, so maybe I could ask you a question if you don't
sure.
Is that a benefit?
Or benefit, yeah. or laboring under the problem of having a lawyer. So when you amend the staff draft, what effect does that have on the final language, I guess?
That is, that becomes the language that will be on the ballot. That's what we're talking about right now.
Okay.
Right. Yeah,
subject to a rehearing, if there's one requested,
okay.
But we will set the ballot language today. And then if there's a rehearing, that language may change based on arguments that the other side.
Okay. I was only confused because I had like two submissions from us. One said draft, one said, you know, just as.
The staff draft is just a tool to help us in setting the title.
Yeah.
I think that on is probably in on line two.
It very rarely gets adopted in the form that it's sent over. So it's just a place to start.
It should be in probably.
How about instead of participation in, if we say cooperation.
Sure.
Instead of participation.
Fine by me.
Yeah.
Cooperation would be fine.
Yeah.
And I think comma after state on line four.
What about just, usually we just say any state or local government.
I'm sorry, didn't you read?
Usually we don't talk about a jurisdiction, which is defined as, we just say any state or local government.
Let me just check the measure because I was just tracking it, but that probably.
The voters don't need to know.
Makes sense.
And it is a little broader than what we would normally think of as a state or local government.
Because it had.
It includes law enforcement agencies and state institutions of higher education.
Yeah, I think that's
and school
why
districts.
I,
and.
However, if I may,
mm-hmm.
Although that was in there, as I understand, placed in there in the original bill simply because it requires it, because the definition of jurisdiction are those things, and they're taxing entities. However, none of those entities, the school districts, the rest, are required to submit anything. They are excluded from the reporting requirement.
Right.
So it,
well, I mean, a school district is still a local government, and a sheriff's department or whatever is still part of a local government.
Well, how about an institution of higher education? I don't think those are or normally considered
as the state. Well, they're state agencies, basically. I mean, they're not agencies. But they're part of the state.
Entities, yeah.
Yeah.
And they are, I don't know if they're, I think they're located. I guess they're not. I don't know if they're technically located in CDHE. I mean, College Department of Higher Education or not, but
I can't hear.
Yeah, but they're still state. Yeah. They're still institute, you know.
Regardless, I think. I don't know that I feel.
That's just
I think if we say this area local, I think you're right. I think we've got it covered.
I mean, we've done that for special districts and all kinds of other strange.
Yeah. I like the brevity of it, too, for obvious reasons. So.
So saying prohibiting state or local government right there?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think you just have to say the state or. Well,
I think.
I'd say the state or a local or any local government.
Okay.
Or their agencies?
After that, well, but that's covered. Yeah, by? I mean that's.
I mean they just act through their agencies. Yeah.
Okay.
And their officials. And in case anyone was wondering, I did take out the law enforcement officers just because I think employees covers them.
I do too. Yeah. So. What is the maintenance or what are we talking about there? Regarding the citizenship or immigration status of any individual or the maintenance.
So I think that was from the language of the measure. I think it seems like you can't say like destroy your records about someone's citizenship.
I think that's modified by, or that modifies restricting the maintenance or intergovernmental sharing.
Right.
It's got to be a better way to say it.
Well, this is what came to my head, so my brain's so I'm just saying that if there's a better way, it's probably not going to come from me, so feel free. I mean, I'm sure there is.
I mean, I think we could just say the maintenance of records, right? Or something. I mean, it's just maintenance by itself. Is maintenance of what?
Does it make it easier if it's just... Is it clear with the other, because see the other term it's the same thing, it just happens to be right in front of such citizenship or immigration status information. If you flip the terms around, does that
That'd
seem
be
to
fine.
Help?
Yeah.
So you just That'd say okay. Individual or the intergovernmental sharing or maintenance of such or maintenance of records relating to or something.
Yeah.
Records of such citizenship or
yeah, maybe just records of. Well, can we get rid of maintenance then and just say records of or records of?
Well, because I don't think it's as I understand it, so it prohibits to it prevents a government from barring or restricting someone from either sharing
the information between governments or maintaining the records of the information. So it's two separate things, I think.
Okay. All right. It's fine with me.
All right. Want to accept those two? You ready?
All right, so right now it's a change to the Colorado Revised Statutes concerning state and local government cooperation in the enforcement of federal immigration laws and in connection therewith, prohibiting the state or any local government from barring or restricting communication with federal immigration agencies regarding the citizenship or immigration status of any individual or the intergovernmental sharing or maintenance of records of such citizenship or immigration status information, prohibiting a jurisdiction from encouraging or facilitating the physical harboring of an illegal immigrant. Do we want to do something with illegal immigrant?
Do we need information on line six?
Well,
I'll pick up on line six when we finish this.
Well, no, now we've added records, maybe not.
How about illegal immigrant? You didn't like it up above.
No, I know I didn't like it up above.
I think we should the terminology.
I'm not an expert in this area of law. Somewhat.
Are we okay with taking information off line six before we move past that? Okay.
Okay.
And now we have jurisdiction.
Yeah.
Right.
Should we say
the state or local government? That was a question. We have a little inconsistent. So I have any local government above. We could go with A, and now we just have, do you prefer just not have an A or an any or anything like that at all? Or
yeah, maybe. I mean, otherwise it.
Just the state or local, the state. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's take out the and any in line three.
And I think we can just say and, right? I mean,
yeah,
it really is both.
Yeah.
Better. And then same on line six. Perfect. Okay. So measure actually. Just looking to find the actual language of it with the harboring.
I'm guessing they use it.
Yeah, the physical, it says the physical harboring of an illegal immigrant. So the physical harboring of an individual not lawfully present in the United States. That, I think that's at least close to the normal use language.
Yeah, I think that's legally correct.
I'm just curious, with the term illegal immigrant, is there an issue with that? I'm just questioning.
Well, I think it can be considered a catchphrase. I mean, I've always been actually a little confused about the term. I mean, I don't know how you're immigrating if you're not here.
Here.
Legally. So, I mean, illegal immigration is, I'm not sure it was ever legally a correct way to describe it.
To describe illegal immigration, was not a correct way to define it, is what you're saying? I'm just curious. I don't.
Well, I think it's just become a catchphrase anyway. I mean, regardless, I don't think it was ever a legal term because immigration is something that happens lawfully. There is no, you know, I mean.
I would respectfully disagree with that. Immigration is just a term that describes the movement of individuals or people groups from one locality to another, usually from two jurisdictions. That can happen legally, but it also can, as we see and have seen often, happen illegally.
But it's not a legal term. I mean, you can't illegally immigrate. I mean, it's become a catchphrase that people use in the media.
But. Short answer is, well, we don't know for sure. Should this measure, you know, should there be a rehearing and the measure be appealed to the Supreme Court, you would probably run the risk using the term illegal immigrant, which is not in the law or statutes, of having the court deem that a catchphrase and, you know, remanding the title back versus if we use this, I feel much more confident that we're safe from that kind of issue.
Okay. Yeah, no, I have an attorney. I'm just curious, so thank you very much.
Yeah, there's a requirement that the board not use a catchphrase, and so if you were here last year for medical aid in dying, you would have heard a lot about, you know, do you call it assisted suicide? Do you call it compassionate? You know, whatever. I mean, both sides generally come in with whatever they think will, you know, tug at the heartstrings of the voters. And so we're supposed to take all the things that would, you know, do that out of the measure and just state it in its non-catchphrase way.
I appreciate it. Thank you. We're ready to read.
Yep. All right. So leaving off where I was, after the colon on line 5, prohibiting state and local government from encouraging or facilitating the physical harboring of an individual not lawfully present in the United States, requiring each jurisdiction to annually notify its elected officials and employees of their duty to comply with federal immigration laws, and requiring annual compliance reporting.
All right. I would move that the board set the title for proposed initiative 2017-18 number 169. As we have modified the staff draft, and it now appears on the screen.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All right.
Thank
probably
you very
see
much.
You in a couple weeks.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. The next, do you want to take a break at all, or are you good?
I can take just five maybe.
Okay.
This one might take a little bit, this all next right. one.
Let's take a 5-minute break, and we'll be back at about 11:05.
Are we all?